From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A look ahead at the work cut out for the United Nations in 2018. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke about his priorities for the year at the General Assembly in New York in an informal meeting Tuesday. This is Secretary General Antonio Guterres at the United Nations in New York.
I took office last year calling for us to make 2017 a year for peace. 1 year later, we must recognize that peace remains elusive. In fundamental ways, the world has gone in reverse. Conflicts have deepened and new dangers have emerged. Global anxieties about nuclear weapons are the highest since the Cold War. And climate change is moving faster than we are. Inequalities are growing. We see horrific violations of human rights. And nationalism, racism, and xenophobia are on the rise. And to me, these are all indications that we need greater unity and courage. Unity and courage to meet today's most urgent needs, to ease the fears of the people we serve, and to set the world on track towards a better future. It is up to member states to define the priorities of UN action. But today, I will highlight 12 areas of concern and one cross-cutting imperative, the empowerment of women everywhere. Excellence. Promouvoir.
Your Excellencies. One, promote a true new deal for a globalization that's fair. Poverty and inequalities are not unavoidable, nor is the unequal distribution of the benefits of globalization an unavoidable result. It's not by chance if eight individuals possess as much wealth as half the poorest population in the world. The way the global economy and international trade work is the result of choices made by human beings. Our choice is the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. Our ambition is to construct prosperous and peaceful societies for all without leaving anyone on the side of the road. Financing is essential to achieve this goal. The Addis Ababa Program of Action sets out the needs and the way of raising resources, in particular by using innovative mechanisms. And I would like to once again make an appeal to governments, and in particular to donors, to fulfill their financing pledges. And I urge the international community to establish effective mechanisms to combat tax evasion, money laundering, and illegal flows of capital so that developing countries can better take advantage of their own resources. By repositioning the United Nations system for development, we want to help member states to better achieve the sustainable development goals, and we need to take advantage of the dynamic development of the private sector and of civil society. And of course, young people deserve need to have a particularly important place in this process. We need to invest in their future. Second, significantly raise our ambitions in terms of combating climate change. In 2016, for the first time in 3 years, CO2 emissions have increased. The five past years have been the hottest years on record. The Paris Accord established the framework for action. However, the commitments undertaken so far will not be enough to attain the goals established. We will need to also raise our ambitions on this point. Luckily, the opportunities for action to combat climate change have never been as significant as today. I have heard that it's said that the Stone Age did not end because of a lack of stones. Well, nothing It's useless to wait until we have no more coal or oil to leave the age of fossil fuels. We need to develop the green economy so that our Earth has a future. We need to invest in the future, not in the past. Next year, I will organize a summit on the climate to mobilize partners in order to mitigate the effects of climate change, adapting to climate change, and to energy transition, which we need so much. Third, take advantage of human mobility. The adoption of the global pact for safe, ordered, and regular migration is one of the most important tasks that we will need to accomplish this year. I've said it before and I'll repeat it. Migrations are a positive phenomenon. Migration promotes economic growth, reduces inequalities, establishes connections between societies, and helps us tackle demographic challenges. But they also are at the heart of political tensions and human tragedies. This is why we need to create many more opportunities for legal migration and give people an opportunity to work and live in dignity in their own countries as a key goal of the our strategy for development and our strategy for development cooperation. This is the only way for us to combat against smugglers and traffickers and to protect those who are the victims of these individuals. Your Excellencies, fourthly, we need to take advantage of the benefits of the fourth industrial revolution while we protect ourselves from its threats. Technological progress can help provide responses to the most urgent challenges of today's world. At the same time, we know that technology can exacerbate inequality. Artificial intelligence will have a dramatic impact on labor markets and societies. Genetic engineering implies serious ethical dilemmas. Cybersecurity threats are increasing and privacy is at risk. The United Nations are committed to serve as a forum where member states, the private sector, scientists, and civil society can engage in debate on the path to take in the future on these issues, as well as to control their potential to benefit everyone.
Fifth, achieving the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula without sleepwalking our way into calamity. I welcome the firm decisions the Security Council has taken in response to nuclear tests and ballistic missile launches by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. They must be fully implemented. But the Council unity also paves the way for diplomatic engagement. That is why last month I sent the Undersecretary General for Political Affairs to Pyongyang for the first in-depth political exchange of views between the United Nations Secretariat and the DPRK officials in almost 8 years. I welcome the reopening of inter-Korean communication channels, especially military to military. This is critical to lower the risk of miscalculation or misunderstanding and to reduce tensions. I'm also encouraged by the decision of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea to participate in the upcoming Winter Olympics in the Republic of Korea. I will be there myself in the opening ceremony. We need to build on these small signs of hope and expand diplomatic efforts to achieve the peaceful denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula in the context of regional security. Six, disengaging the mess in the broader Middle East. The situation in the broader Middle East has become a Gordian knot. With so many interrelated flashpoints, the risk of an escalatory cycle is real. We must press for a return to negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. There is no alternative to a two-state solution, and recent signals of diminishing support for these undermine moderates and empower radicals. There is no plan B. In Lebanon, let us all work to preserve the country's sovereignty and stability and strengthen state institutions. In Yemen, it's time for the parties to enter into meaningful peace negotiations beyond the efforts to ease the dramatic humanitarian catastrophe. Looking at the Gulf, we must seize all opportunities to establish and strengthen platforms for regional dialogue to ease tensions, to avoid escalations, and allow for political solutions to emerge. In Syria, the United Nations will continue its engagements toward genuine, representative, and direct inter-Syrian negotiations in Geneva, leading to a political settlement of the conflict. And in Iraq, we will support all efforts to ensure the country's territorial integrity, pursue inclusive governance, and ease sectarian tensions. Seventh, strengthening our partnership with the African Union. I'm a strong believer in African-led solutions to African problems. The African Union and the United Nations have a shared interest in strengthening mechanisms to defuse conflicts before they escalate and to manage them effectively where they occur. It is essential for the international community to fully support the efforts of the African Union and sub-regional organizations, especially when traditional peacekeeping models are not enough and where peace enforcement and counterterrorism are needed. An effective and well-funded African peace and security architecture remains a global strategic imperative. In Somalia, around Lake Chad, as well as in the Sahel, African forces require solid support from the international community and the United Nations with clear mandates and adequate and predictable financing. And I also remain totally committed to supporting Libyan actors in securing a political agreement and fully implementing the roadmap presented by my special representative, leading to parliamentary and presidential elections. Eighth, removing the paralysis that has left European conflicts fester and freeze. Having started two world wars and taking into account the resources and capacities available to Europe, it is unjustifiable for conflicts in the region to persist. Resolving these situations requires pushing back the dangerous tide of nationalism and revitalizing the relevant mediation initiatives, including the Normandy Format and Trilateral Contact Group on Eastern Ukraine, the OSCE Minsk Group on Nagorno-Karabakh, Geneva International Discussions related to Georgia, and 5+2 process on Transnistria. A concerted effort for solutions leading to long-term stability in the Western Balkans is also urgent. And I urge European leaders to show that the continent can live up to its ideals of shared prosperity and peaceful coexistence. Ninth, maintaining a strong focus on counterterrorism. There are distinct links between conflicts and the spread of terrorism. It is clear that in countries like Afghanistan, moves towards peace would advance the fight against the terrorism that plagues that country and spreads well beyond its borders. Terrorism needs globally coordinated responses to defeat it. And in June, I will convene a summit of heads of counterterrorism agencies to advance multilateral cooperation in this vital struggle. It is also critical to focus on root causes and support victims. Our actions must be grounded in respect for human rights and the rule of law, and we must avoid approaches that feed the grievances and narratives that may generate the very violence we seek to eliminate. In short, in preventing and combating terrorism, we should be both tough and smart. Tenth, strengthening United Nations peace operations. Peacekeeping is facing unprecedented challenges. Our missions are increasingly deployed in difficult environments where there is little peace to keep. Many times ill-equipped, our peacekeepers are now deliberately targeted. This situation is not sustainable. It's time to sound an alarm. I am determined to improve our peacekeeping performance, to better protect ourselves and the populations we serve. A detailed plan of action for that purpose is being prepared by the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. But we can only do it with more engagement and support from all member states, as troop or police contributors, as financial contributors, as partners in political efforts and in the Security Council. I thank our troop and police contributing countries for their generosity and pay tribute to all personnel who have given their lives in the line of duty. Peacekeeping must be seen in the context of the whole peace continuum, with prevention as our clear priority. Next month, I will present to you my report on peace building and sustaining peace as required by the General Assembly, which we hope will galvanize our efforts to prevent violent conflicts. The Mediation Advisory Board is also up and running. One of its members, President Olusegun Obasanjo, has just undertaken its first initiative in support of the successful elections and political transition underway in Liberia. We have already planned a number of other missions with the agreement of the countries concerned to member states facing stability challenges. 11th, reversing the large-scale exodus of Myanmar Rohingya Muslims. Cast out of their homes and country and subjected to brutality, both by military forces and others, they are under siege as a group for who they are. They desperately need immediate life-saving assistance, long-term solutions, and justice. I call on the government to ensure unfettered humanitarian access in Rakhine State, and I appeal to the international community to support those who have fled to Bangladesh. The agreement between Bangladesh and Myanmar, I hope, will pave the way to what is needed, the safe, voluntary, dignified, and sustainable return of refugees to their places of origin in accordance with international standards that will be, of course, critical. Full implementation of the Rakhine Advisory Commission recommendations is also vital, and I remain strongly committing to support Myanmar's democratic transition through these difficult moments. 12th, overcoming the false contradiction between human rights and national sovereignty. Human rights and national sovereignty go hand in hand. The achievement of human rights strengthens states and societies, thereby reinforcing sovereignty. And states with effective, accountable institutions are among the best defenders of human rights. The United Nations stands ready to support states in building their capacities to uphold the rule of law and promote respect on human rights, all civil, political, economic, social, and cultural, and to eliminate all forms of discrimination. A vibrant civil society and free press have also central roles to play. In the 70th year of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, let us be guided by that mighty document's aspirations and guarantees. And this is also the spirit of the Human Rights Upfront initiative, to which I remain fully committed. Ladies and gentlemen, in each of these 12 areas, we can see the disproportionate impact on women, from conflicts to climate change to mass migration. We can also see in the greater equality and inclusion of women a fundamental tool to address these complex challenges. Women's meaningful participation in peace and security has been proven to make peace more sustainable. And women's equal participation in the labor force and equal pay would unlock trillions of dollars for our economies. To achieve such gains, however, greater action is needed. And my approach rests on three pillars. First, empowerment, empowering women and girls. Power is the heart of the matter. I have launched a roadmap for achieving gender parity at all levels of the United Nations. With the appointment I announced yesterday, we have reached, far in advance, full parity in the 44 member of the United Nations Senior Management Group. I have requested that all of our reforms make explicit how they are strengthening our capacity to deliver on gender equality. And I have mandated an internal task force to review the UN's own spending on gender equality. Second, preventing sexual exploitation and abuse against women. Our organization's first ever victims' rights advocate is now in place, working closely with states and across the United Nations system. 82 member states are part of a voluntary compact to prevent these crimes and respond swiftly to allegations. 58 world leaders are showing their resolve by standing with me in a circle of leadership. There is a long way to go, but we are totally determined. Third, preventing and addressing sexual harassment. I reiterate my personal commitment to eliminate sexual harassment from our organization. My zero tolerance approach was recently reaffirmed in a joint letter with staff unions to all our personnel. And I've also set up a task force led by Jan Beagle of the Department of Management to review UN policies and capacities to investigate, to ensure accountability, and to look at the support and protection offered to those affected. We are working on more detailed measures to simplify the procedures for reporting harassment and to raise awareness of this very serious issue throughout our organization. Excellencies, this will be a decisive year for reform. The General Assembly has taken important decisions. You have my reports and proposals, and I've listened hard to your comments and suggestions. As we have been debating it in several sessions, I will not develop the issue today. The period ahead of us must set the course towards peace and prosperity. I've just returned from a visit to Colombia, where I saw inspiring advances towards peace and reconciliation, but also the challenges that such processes inevitably entail. I draw hope from our work there and from the courage and resilience of the Colombian people. All our challenges, everything everywhere, demand an investment of time, money, energy, political capital, and more. Member states must assume their leadership, but everyone everywhere can do something to make our world more safe, sustainable, and secure. Even in the face of headwinds and hatred, we must uphold the values of the United Nations Charter. But we can only do that together as United Nations and one human family. Thank you.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking in New York on Tuesday about the plans of his administration over the coming year. At the close of that meeting, the Secretary General sat with the press and took questions, and we bring you some highlights from that session.
Sherwin Briceby, South African Broadcasting, and Secretary General, welcome back to our favorite room at the United Nations, and we certainly look forward to engaging you throughout 2018, and good luck with the 12 points. In your remarks to the General Assembly earlier, you said that the world had gone in reverse, that racism, nationalism, and xenophobia were on the rise. You will also be aware of the recent derogatory comments attributed to the United States President as it relates to immigration from Africa and Haiti. You'd also be aware, sir, of the statement from the Africa Group of Ambassadors here at the United Nations and the African Union condemning what it called outrageous, racist, and xenophobic remarks. Do you support their call for a retraction and an apology from the United States President?
Well, as far as I understand, the United States President has denied that he has said that. Our position is very clear. We need to have relations of mutual respect with all peoples in the world. And in particular, migration is a positive aspect. And migrants contribute not only to the welfare of their countries of origin, but to the welfare of the countries where they are part of the development process. The respect for migrants and the respect for diversity, ethnic diversity, religious diversity, is a fundamental pillar of the United Nations, and it will be a fundamental pillar of the action of the Secretary General.
James Bayes from Al Jazeera. You and your predecessor have repeatedly said there's no military solution in Syria. And yet right now we have Turkey readying itself for possible military action. We have the US planning a new Kurdish border security force, and we have the Syrian government, backed by the Russians, actively pursuing a military solution with a bombardment in Idlib and eastern Ghouta, and the same Syrian government, when it goes to Geneva, not engaging fully with the political process. With that backdrop, how do you reinvigorate the peace efforts, and is Sochi part of that?
I think that that backdrop only shows how important it is to revigorate the Geneva process. And to revigorate the Geneva process, we are making all efforts in order to make sure that both government and opposition give positive contributions to make the process move forward. We were in Riyadh, and I believe Riyadh too was a very important moment to bring the different strands of the opposition together and to have the opposition participating constructively.
We have been, as you know, the positions we have assumed in relation to the last Geneva meeting. A new meeting was convened to Geneva, or probably to another location close to Geneva. And we hope that this time it will be possible to have constructive dialogue between government and opposition. Our position in relation to Sochi is still dependent on how things will develop in between. We believe that what you said only proves that after all these years, if so many are still betting on military operations, it is clear that there is no military solution.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary General. Ali Barada from Sharq al-Awsat and from France 24. A follow-up to James' question. Do you see that there is a significant role that should be played by President Bashar al-Assad in the solution that planned for Syria? And are you happy about the work that has been done by your special envoy, Stefan de Mistura, and why? Thank you.
I am happy with the work Stefan de Mistura has done. I think it's really almost a miracle that he was able to stay the course and make this process move forward with all the difficulties and all the problems and all the obstacles that we have witnessed. We have asked both government and opposition to put no preconditions for the discussion. And so I'm not going to put myself a precondition in relation to the presidency of Syria. It is essential for the two parties to come and discuss without preconditions. And of course, obviously, the questions of governance, the questions of elections, and the questions of constitution are very important. And each one is entitled to have each one's position. But what for us is more important at the present moment is to make sure that a meaningful dialogue starts between government and opposition without preconditions.
Towards a transition?
Sorry?
Towards a transition as called by Security Council Resolution 2254.
Every aspect of the resolution is on the table. Constitution, elections, and transition. We have tried to organize the debate in a way that allow it to move forward, but none of these aspects is out of the table.
Mr. Secretary General, Carol Landry from Agence France-Presse. I wanted to ask you about North Korea. Do you think that war is avoidable in 2018 with North Korea? And you mentioned small signs of hope. And some people are dismissive that sending musicians and figure skaters to the South is going to make a real difference. And while you're at the Winter Olympics, will there be an opportunity for diplomacy? Thank you.
Well, I believe war is avoidable. What I'm worried is that I'm not yet sure that peace is guaranteed. And that is why we are so strongly engaged. As you know, I've sent my Undersecretary of Political Affairs to Pyongyang. Today, I was very happy when the ambassador, the permanent representative of the Republic of Korea, said that this visit has contributed to the restart of the dialogue between the two Koreas. I think there are some signals of hope. What I believe is extremely important is to take profit of these signals of hope to make sure that a serious process leading to the peaceful denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula takes place. I think there is a window of opportunity. That window of opportunity will, in my opinion, hopefully make the war available. But it is important that we don't miss the opportunities that windows can provide.
Thank you. Betulürk, Turkish news agency, Anadolu. I'd like to ask about the U.S. decision to establish a border security forces on the Syrian border. The decision has already led to tension between Turkey and the U.S., and Russia also warned about a possible division in the country, and Syria sees it as an attack on its sovereignty. I was wondering if you have a comment or any concerns about this decision. Thank you.
As you know, too many countries have had troops in Syria. I think if the Syrian people could be able to solve alone its problems, it would probably be much better.
Abadi from Le Dossier du Maroc. The Chinese president said, and I quote, "A good China-U.S. cooperation will serve as an anchor for global stability and a booster for world peace." In your capacity as the Secretary General of the United Nations, What importance do you attribute to these bilateral relations in the promotion of peace and security in the world?
A vital importance.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.